then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's September the 30th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. All right, this week I'm going to have to do something that I normally don't do. I'm going to have to more or less ad-lib this entire podcast. Fact is, things have come to a crunch this week. It would be a rough week anyway because I would not only have to do a Radio Free Northwest, but because it's the end of the month, I also have to do a Northwest Observer for October. For those of you who are not familiar with Northwest Observer, it is our monthly magazine that the Northwest Front publishes. Now, that would be difficult enough, but some other stuff has come up that I have to handle, and which is going to take up pretty much most of my time all week. I've already mentioned to some of you in the past, both by email and in personal conversation, my need for a personal assistant who was physically here, physically present by my side to help out. And I've mentioned that the absence of such an assistant is starting to seriously interfere with my work, and this is an example. Basically, I just got so jammed up this week that something had to give. And what had to give was writing the Radio Free Northwest script. So what I'm going to be doing is I'm just going to sit here and gabble for about 2 hours. And hopefully I'll be able to edit out all the E's and uhs and buzz and does and blah, 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 and put together something coherent. Not too much of an Edgar Steele update this week. Because once again, we're in one of those situations in a criminal case where everyone's just sort of sitting around waiting for something to happen. The last really big development, of course, was Cindy Steele's blockbuster affidavits protesting against the plea bargain for Larry Fairfax, the guy that actually wired a bomb to her car. There has been a hearing set for October the 7th, wherein the judge will rule on Cindy's objections to the Fairfax plea deal. The Free Edgar Steele website has also published the initial criminal complaint against Fairfax, wherein I noted that he was actually arrested by an ATF agent after the bomb was discovered on Cindy Steele's car, and I can't help but wonder how that ATF agent felt when he was made to understand afterwards that he had arrested a longtime FBI informant who was almost certainly acting on the directions of the FBI as he broke the law. I'm sure that caused a few interagency red faces. There's one other thing I want to mention about the Steele case, and that's something I noticed and forgot to mention last week. I noticed that Ed Steele's trial has been scheduled for November the 1st. Now, what happens on November the 2nd? The midterm elections. And the news media are going to be full of nothing but Obama this and Republicans that and Nancy Pelosi this and Republicans cleaning up in the House that and blah, 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 blah. And there's going to be a lot of sound and fury and general dog and pony show over the elections, which will, of course, have the effect of obscuring a lot of the media coverage on the Ed Steele case. It will tend to get pushed onto, well, in the old days, I'd say it'd get pushed back to page 16 of the newspaper, but nobody reads newspapers anymore. So the Edgar Steele case will, shall we say, kind of vanish off the web or off CNN or wherever one gets one's news. And I can't help but wonder if that's deliberate on the part of the federal government. They're deliberately scheduling the trial at a time when they know that the public's attention is going to be turned somewhere else. Sounds like it. This whole thing reeks of fabrication, and I think the feds have finally figured out what a weak hand they're holding. I honestly, from what I know about the case, I can't figure out how anyone can expect a jury to convict Edgar Steele on the so-called evidence that we've seen. Everything, of course, is going to stand and fall on these alleged tapes of Edgar Steele asking Fairfax to murder his wife and his mother-in-law. Cindy and her mother have both gone on record now with their affidavits as more or less stating that they don't believe it. And so we'll just have to see how that plays out. The problem, of course, is what kind of jury is Steele going to get? I'm sure what will happen is the prosecutor will impanel a jury of your basic white morons, and she will lose no opportunity to remind the white morons that Edgar Steele is a wicked, evil racist and blah, 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 and she'll bring in his book, Defense of Racism, and I'm sure she will find occasion to remind the jury again and again how Edgar Steele defended that awful Pastor Butler who lowered their property values and all this happy horse shit, so I still am not too sanguine about his chances. I don't want to go so far as to call the feds incompetent in putting together this frame-up, because it may well be that, incompetent or not, they get what they aimed for in the end, which is the personal destruction of Edgar Steele. I'm still not sure why. I don't understand the motive behind this. Steele wasn't actually doing anything. He had already rescinded his publicly announced intentions of running for governor due to his health situation, and as near as I can figure, it has to be just personal vindictiveness, just plain sheer meanness on the part of somebody in the government that Edgar Steele pissed off. Or maybe it's this real estate tycoon that runs Northern Idaho, I can't remember his name. Who knows? But obviously there is something very weird going on here. I do, of course, wish Ed all the best, and hopefully more will come out in the future and at his trial, and a situation will be created where even a jury full of brainwashed liberal white morons will have no choice but to acquit him. Anyway, we'll keep you updated on what's going on there. Another interesting little tidbit that's come up over the past week, I run a blog called Thought Crime. The actual URL is downwithjugears, all one word, downwithjugears.blogspot.com, but the title of the blog is Thought Crime. As you can tell from the title, Down with Jug Ears, I actually first put that blog up online during the time of George W. Bush. It's been up for about 5 years now. I'm frankly amazed that it has stayed up with all the complaints it's generated, but every now and then the niggers and the liberals and the left-wing nuts and the Jews and whatnot will find this blog, and they'll discover something on there that just shocks the hell out of them. Oh, this is wicked evil racism, and they get hysterical, and all of a sudden I'm getting, you know, 10,000 hits a day. Now, this happened last week. We got a brief mention on Matt Drudge with regard to monkey pictures of Michelle Obama. This was, I think about a month or so ago. And there was a big surge of initial interest in this one post on the blog. And now, it's, for some reason, that has revived, and I'm getting about 5,000 or 6,000 hits a day now, mostly from niggers and stupid idiots and whatnot, and some idiots are circulating it on Facebook, and so it's going the rounds of the internet. And I'm getting, you know, 70 or 80 nasty, stupid comments from assholes. And, of course, a lot of favorable comments as well. Anyway, you might want to check out that URL. It's the Thought Crime blog, http://downwithjugears.blogspot.com. I won't try to post the URL here for that specific post. It's the post from September the 19th, 2009. So when you go to the blog, what you'll have to do is you'll have to go down into the past post. You'll have to click on September 2009. And you'll have to find the post for September 19th, 2009, and the title of the post is Get That Worthless Nigger Out of the White House. And it's one of the lone haranguer's inimitable rants. And there's a graphic on there that shows Barack Obama and Michelle Obama morphing into apes. I don't know who did this, but it's just hysterical. It's kind of creepy and it's kind of funny at the same time. But apparently that graphic, that picture of the Obamas as monkeys, is what just freaks these niggers and these left-wing idiots and these liberals out. Anyway, those of you who like to play with niggers on the internet, go check out that post and you can add your 2 cents worth. I did approve some of the nasty posts just to give you guys a sample of what's been going on and what happens when our negroid friends discover something on the internet they don't like. Some people I know like to play with niggers and play with lefty fools on the internet. Okay, we have a number of email questions from Elizabeth in Oregon, and I'll get into them now. I probably won't be able to get to all of them before the first music break. Anyway, her email says, "Hello all, I'm pretty new to all of this and brand new to this site. It simply took me a while to actually feel okay to start talking to people and looking for ways to preserve our race. For years now, I've hated subgroups and have been quite open about it." I presume she means minorities like niggers and spics and bugger boys. "I find it a quite novel experience having so many people in agreement, and passionately so, against these subgroups. After having read a good percentage, if not a majority, of the posts on this site, I feel that I'm at least a good step of the way to helping the cause by being an Aryan already living here in the Northwest. And truthfully, I can't imagine living anywhere else. I've traveled the world, loved most of it, but this is home. There are some great pockets of majority white cities, although Salem is definitely not one of them, frequently referred to as Spicville. All that being said, I have a few questions which I would like answered that I didn't find answers to before I fully commit myself and my family to this cause. First, quote, the basic building block of the new society must be the traditional nuclear two-parent family with the gainfully employed husband and father as head of the family and the homemaking wife and mother as its heart. Now the question is, how strongly does the group feel that the woman should be a homemaker? Okay, first off, Elizabeth, I'm trying to remember from your previous emails that we've exchanged whether or not you have read the Northwest novels. Now, as I've said before on these podcasts, it's kind of difficult for me to talk to people who haven't read the novels because the four Northwest novels are, in fact, my major FAQ facility. I tried to raise and deal with every conceivable objection, every conceivable question that anyone could have about the Northwest migration or the way forward in those novels. Now, there is, in fact, a section from A Mighty Fortress that I persistently send to people who ask questions like this, mostly women. It is a scene where two Northwest volunteers, one female and one male, are going to sleep together, not to bed, because they've got a mission in the morning and, you know, they've got to be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Anyway, they end up talking about the relative role of the sexes in the revolution. I won't attempt to read that section on here because it contains dialogue, and one of the things I've always resisted is me sitting here like some kind of J.K.R. Rowling and reading out my own work. But what I will do is I will send you that section from A Mighty Fortress privately, and that will get into some of our, you know, views on the sex thing. I mentioned in my last FAQ that I was going to get into the whole man-woman thing, but I felt that I had sufficiently dealt with it already. And, of course, needless to say, the one issue that I didn't deal with in last week's FAQ is the one that comes up this week. What I will do, Elizabeth, is I will try to locate the Radio Free Northwest podcast in which I deal with the role of women in the movement, and I will send that to you, and I'll ask you to go to that and listen to that podcast. I am not trying to bat you aside. I'm not trying to avoid the issue, but again, this is something I have already gone into about 50 times, and so I'll have to try and make it very brief here. There is a common misconception that right-wing people and racialist people and Northwest nationalists or National Socialists or whatever want to shove women back in the kitchen and keep them barefoot and pregnant and chained to the bed and blah, 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 blah. This is simply not true. And since I'm ad-libbing this week, my mind just has pulled a blank here. I've gone, again, it's one of these things, I've gone over this so many damn times, and now when I have to ad-lib it, my mind just goes blank. Elizabeth, no, it's not true. We're not going to make you slaves. We're not going to make you harem girls. We're not going to force you to have, 12 babies and all this sort of stuff and blah, 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 blah. All I have to say is I will find the appropriate references for you and I will send you to them, okay? This is a complex question, the whole relationship between men and women in the white movement, and I don't feel like ad-libbing it. Okay, next question. Sexual perversion such as homosexuality, lesbianism, transvestism, feminism, pornography, pedophilia, and the traffic in materials relating to all the preceding will be permanently suppressed. I see that someone's been reading our Constitution. The question is, what is the definition of feminism used by the Northwest Front, and why is pornography included in that list, and what will be the consequences for such charges? Okay, now, first off, the definition of feminism is the belief, Jewish in origin, that men and women are enemies or competitors of some kind. The belief that men are in some way engaged in some kind of world conspiracy to keep women down and suppress them and take away their rights and keep them barefoot and pregnant and chained to the stove, etc., etc., etc. Feminism is the belief that men and women have no common interest, put it that way. Feminism is the belief that life should be one constant contest or game of one-upmanship between men and women. And finally, feminism is the outright belief that women should dominate the whole male-female sexual dynamic and basically should wear the pants in the whole family. And in essence, we should live in a matriarchal society. And I repeat that this is very much of Jewish origin. And if you don't believe me, look at the women who originated it. Germaine Greer, Gloria Steinemann, Shulamith Firestone, Andrea Dworkin, Bella Abzug. I mean, need I go on? More so even than Marxism itself. Feminism is a purely Jewish construct, and that's because it's based on the Jewish male-female dynamic which occurs in Jewish households. Now, you've heard of the Jewish mother that more or less castrates and dominates and really screws up their male children and raise their female children to be other Jewish mothers? Well, some time ago, I put a post on one of my blogs called Jewish Women, and I was poking fun at Jewish women in Hollywood and calling them ugly and so forth and so on. I have always been amazed by the reaction I get. I repost that every year or so, and every time I do, I get an avalanche of responses in the comments section. Some of them are, of course, are abusive and insulting and whatnot from Jewesses or whatever. But what always surprises me is the number of Jewish men that I have posting comments on that particular item and telling me that I've got it spot on. I've had more than one Jewish man post to that particular section of the blog and tell me that, yes, Jewish mothers and Jewish women really are as bad as they're made out to be. I've dealt with this in my novels as well, and you will notice that most successful Jewish men generally choose Gentile women to marry, because no really successful and strong and independent Jewish man wants to marry his mother in the, you know, psychological sense of the word. I think everyone pretty much agrees down through history that as bad as Jews as a whole are, Jewish women are real bitches. And one of the outstanding characteristics of the Jewish woman was always the complete domination not only of the household but of the husband and the whole kit and caboodle. Basically, Jewish society is a matriarchal society. As powerful and nasty and vicious as Jewish men may be outside the home, inside the home, they don't dare let out a squeak. If you really ever want to see the whole dynamic of a Jewish household and a Jewish family, read A Piece of Filth by Philip Roth called Portnoy's Complaint, and you will see what I mean about the whole role of the Jewish woman in the family. She is an enervating, dominating, castrating, crushing experience. And feminism, as we know it, is essentially an attempt by the Jews to, how can I say, overwrite Aryan and European cultural norms with their own neurotic formulations, just like psychoanalysis is. You know, Freudian psychoanalysis is great. It's perfectly accurate so long as it's applied to Jews. Sigmund Freud was a Jew, and the method of analysis that he developed is perfectly valid so long as it's applied to Jews. And feminism is the same thing. It's an attempt by the Jewish people to impose their cultural norms and their cultural ideas and their neurosis on the rest of humanity. Now, you can really tell I'm ad-libbing this because I'm babbling like hell, but you get what I'm saying here, Elizabeth. Feminism teaches that men and women are enemies and have to be in competition with each other, and I cannot think of an idea that is more destructive to the true Aryan family than that. Men and women are not inferior or superior to one another. They're different. They're two halves of a whole. One cannot exist without the other. The traditional division of labor in the Aryan family has always been the gainfully employed man working and supporting the family as the head of the family and the homemaking mother as the heart of the family. And that is the family unit, that is the cultural dynamic, if you will, the building block of Western society that has created Western civilization. All of the greatest eras and civilizations and nations of our people down through history have been in times and places where that kind of family dynamic prevailed. Times and the nations and places and eras when we get in trouble, historically speaking, have been when that family unit is in some way undermined. And I'm babbling here, and I need to kind of get back on track, but I think you can understand what I'm saying here, Elizabeth. And once again, I have gone over this repeatedly, and I will send you all the necessary references so that you can actually sit and read the answers to these yourself. and I really need to shut up here. All right, now I think it's time for the first music break while I get my thoughts together and try and get myself to stop mumbling. I think what we're going to have this week is a 1960s and 1970s folk music festival. I don't know how many of you remember that particular era, but there was a sort of explosion of hippy-dippy type folk music. All of it, of course, very leftist and very so-called subversively chic or chicly subversive or whatever. A lot of course, rewriting of history, a lot of emphasizing of various leftist causes, etc. Of course, the monarch and exemplar of all the 1960s folk singers was Pete Seeger. But there was actually some pretty good music recorded during that era, and not all of it was left-wing drivel. There was, in fact, a legitimate folk music revival, both here and in Britain, that did manage, I think, to save a lot of our musical cultural heritage. Anyway, I guess because I grew up in that particular time, I do like the music of some of those groups. This is one of the better groups from that period of that 60s and 70s folk revival. It's called Pentangle, and this is called Rain and Snow.
Ran me out in the cold rain and snow. She gave me trouble all my life. Ran me out in the cold rain and snow.
Rain and snow.
Came running on down the stair, combing back her long yellow hair, and her cheeks were as red as the rose.
As the rose, as the rose,
and her cheeks were as red as the rose.
By the way, one thing I would like to mention just in passing here by way of current events, I'm now going to take a long shot here, and I'm going to say that Sarah Palin will be the Republican nominee for president in 2012. Now, my basis for this is that I listened to Rush Limbaugh, as I have confessed before, and I noticed that Limbaugh is defending Sarah Palin pretty consistently and pretty passionately against the various liberal attacks against her, which I have to admit, even though I don't think much of Sarah Palin, what the liberal media is doing to her is absolutely unconscionable. But the thing is, Rush Limbaugh doesn't utter a squeak unless it's been approved by his lords and masters in the country club Republican set. And although he is attacking rhinos and whatnot recently, I think that may be part of a strategy on the part of the Republican Party. Limbaugh is not going to bite the hand that feeds him. He is basically a neocon. His attitude towards Israel is the usual one of calf-eyed worship. And I just can't see Limbaugh going off on an independent streak here and deciding that he's actually going to stand up for genuine conservatives against the wishes of the Republican Party bosses. Limbaugh basically is a tool of capitalism, and hence he is also a tool of the Republican Party, which is the political wing of capitalism. So somehow or other, Limbaugh has gotten the okay from the really rich people who run this country to defend Sarah Palin and plug her as a possible presidential candidate in 2012. Now, in point of fact, that would, of course, be disastrous. Sarah Palin is just about the only candidate who could lose to Barack Obama in a contest like that, I think, because she is so obviously as dumb as a bag of hammers. This tends to prove a theory that I have long held, and that is that the Democrats and the Republicans have an arrangement whereby presidents will be elected for two consecutive 4-year terms to make a total of 8 years, and then they switch. Now, we've had this pattern for almost a generation now, beginning with, well, Clinton, I should say. George H. Bush was a 1-term president, but Clinton did 2 terms, and then we had, of course, 8 years of Jug Ears and his little Jewish friends, and now we're probably going to get 8 years of Obama, whether we want it or not. And I think part of the technique by which this result is assured is that during the, what you might call the midterm election, the election after the first presidential term of a new president, the opposing party agrees to run a complete and total unelectable doofus. And if you look at the candidates that both the Republicans and Democrats have fielded during these halfway point elections in the past, I think that bears up. In 1996, the Republicans ran Mr. Baker the Undertaker, Bob Dole, Mumbly Joe, as the Simpsons called him. Someone once referred to that candidacy as the Republicans unearthing the most freezer-burned mummy from their crypt, and I don't think that was too far off. Then in 2000, the Democrats ran Al Gore, who seems to be some kind of proof that the invasion of the body snatchers actually took place. He talks like he's been replaced by a pod person. Of course, in those days, we didn't know that he was really the sex poodle that attacks masseuses in Portland hotel rooms. So it turns out that Mr. Gore does have at least a little bit of life in him, so to speak. But anyway, in 2004, the Democrats ran John Kerry, who, again, was just totally hopeless in the charisma field. But what I'm getting at is this pattern of 2 4-year terms per party seems to be setting in as a kind of a political norm in this country. I think if the Republicans are sticking to this pattern, they're going to want to put up a candidate in 2012 who has not a hope of winning. And the trouble is that with a Democratic candidate like Barry, if a pink elephant ran against Barack Obama in 2012, he'd probably win. I think the Republicans are going to have a hard time picking a candidate who can lose to Obama. But it looks like they may have found one in Sarah Palin, hence Rush Limbaugh's sudden championing of her against her various critics. Anyway, that's just an observation of mine. We'll see how that plays out. Several broadcasts ago, I did a segment on the late Commander George Lincoln Rockwell, who was one of the greatest and most dynamic figures that our white racial resistance movement has ever produced. Now, in response to that segment, a listener sent me this clip of a radio interview that Commander Rockwell did on the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, in 1966. And you will now have the privilege of hearing Commander Rockwell speak for himself.
Commander George Lincoln Rockwell, you are head of the American Nazi Party?
Yes, sir.
How can you possibly justify leading an organization whose objectives are the liquidation of the Jews, the removal of the Negroes to Africa and the turning of the United States into a fascist state.
Well, I don't know where you got those supposed objectives, but they're ridiculous. We have no such objectives. As you have said, we are not out to liquidate the Jews. We are out to liquidate communist traitors. Unfortunately, too many Jewish atheists, not religious Jews, but too many religious atheist Jews are mixed up in communism. That's our only concern with the Jews. And as for turning us into a fascist nation, that's untrue too. Fascism is essentially an economic doctrine that has to do with a corporate state. We don't believe in a corporate state. We believe in free enterprise. What we are is Nazis, which means basically that we are racists. We believe in preserving a white nation, a white Christian nation, for the white Christian people who build it.
Well, now let's deal with the Jews first and the Negroes second. Are you happy with that order?
Any way you want to deal with them.
How would you deal with them, Commander?
I think we'll deal with them simultaneously when we get our chance.
How do you mean?
Well, I think that the Negroes, who have done nothing wrong, in my opinion, except recently, but they did no wrong by coming here. We dragged them here, and I think we owe them something. I think we owe them a chance in their own nation in Africa.
Then you do intend to deport the Negroes to Africa?
You keep saying these things, sir, not me. Not deport them. Those who wish to may remain here on reservations, like the Indians were. Those who will, of their own volition, accept our help, will be aided to go over to Africa and build their own nation, as our ancestors, and yours, I might say, came over here and did in America.
Now, the Jews, you say about 80% of them are communists and traitors.
You keep adding this stuff. I don't know whether it's 80%. I don't know what
Commander, what percentage would you estimate?
My estimate has been regularly about 80% based on the number of traitors who have been convicted in this country, in your country, in England, and other countries.
All right. What do you intend to do to those Jews who you believe are communists or traitors?
The Constitution provides that. The Constitution of the United States is written by the Founding Fathers, says death is the penalty for treason. I believe that. That's the only way to deal with a traitor. I think they should be placed before American juries in American courts of law, federal courts, and if they're convicted by law of treason, I think they should be executed.
What's your view on the way that Hitler dealt with the Jews of Germany?
I think Hitler dealt with the Jews of Germany the same way he dealt with all traitors, the same way we will. I think he has been lied about more than any human being in history except Jesus Christ.
Do you, in fact, accept what has been established by many?
Are you reputable island out there telling me about the 6 million dead Jews?
That's what I'm coming up to. But I'm going to put
that.
Do you or do you not?
Well, let me tell you a little story.
That 6 million Jews were exterminated by Hitler.
Of course not. I have incontrovertible documentary proof that that's not true. I don't know how many Jews there were in Germany. I think I heard there were 600,000. And if the percentage is anything like I think it's over here, I don't think they were exterminated, but I would imagine probably as many as 500,000 probably had to be dealt with as traitors, according to law, as there will be here.
Well, then, if 500,000 Jews are thereabouts in your view, and this is about 1/12 of the estimate which is accepted by everybody else, if 500,000 were exterminated,
Wait a minute. Did we exterminate the Rosenbergs, sir? Do you call that exterminating them?
Well, now, wait a minute, Commander. You know that it has been thoroughly established by all the courts which have looked into the question, by the governments of the United States, of Great Britain, of the Soviet Union, which have looked into the question.
And you believe the Soviet Union, sir?
That in fact,
let's stop now, right there. How about that Soviet Union? They sat on the International Court of Justice at Nuremberg. Do you believe in the Soviet justice?
Do you disbelieve in the evidence accumulated by your own government of the United States and by the government of Britain as well as the Soviet Union?
The FBI accumulated, sir, but the FBI has not accumulated that. The people that accumulated that so-called evidence were mostly Jewish army officers, who I believe were not working for the United States. They're working for Israel and Russia and the Soviets.
Do you model yourself on Hitler?
It's impossible. I look upon Hitler. If I were religious, I would say Hitler was the second coming of Christ. I think Hitler was a gift from Providence. I think he was so far above anything that I'll be able to accomplish that it's just almost sacrilegious for me to speak of myself in the same terms with Hitler.
But this is your objective, to model yourself as closely as possible.
My objective is to carry out what Hitler started, not to model my own person on Hitler, because this is impossible.
Do you consider yourself the second Führer?
I don't even use the word Führer. I'm not a German. I'm an American, as you're a Canadian. I consider myself, in terms of Bolshevism, I would be the Lenin to Marx. And in terms of Christianity, I'm the St. Paul to Hitler's Christ. In other words, I am the spreader, the world spreader of a doctrine which Hitler originated, and it was crucified, dead and buried, and it is now rising.
Are you a Superman, Commander?
I'm not a Superman. No, there's probably people here could whip me. I think that all I am is the offspring of millions of years of evolution, which has produced white Christian civilization. I am one example of it, not a Superman. But I think that compared to an Aborigine in Africa who eats his grandmother, and they're still eating people over there, I think I am, and so are you. We're all Supermen compared to those cruds.
Didn't Adolf Hitler believe in Superman?
He said the white race is a master race, and I think that's true.
I would like to turn you to the question of the American Negro.
Yeah, let's go. We've got a little more sympathy there. People don't know about the Jews, but they can sure see coons.
Just what, indeed, do you plan to do with the American Negro?
I think what should have been done, it's too late now. I used to back the Muslims, because the Muslims cleaned their people up. They wanted a country of their own in Africa. This is what Elijah Muhammad said. I spoke before 9,000 black Muslims in Chicago, and I was cheered. And the reason for it was is because we saw eye to eye on the business of giving the Negroes some justice in their own land, not here.
Do you, Commander, do you favor the use of violence in dealing with the Negroes?
If the Negroes show us any violence, I sure as hell do. But so long as they remain within the law, I believe it can be done voluntarily, not by violence. I believe the only way it could have been solved, I think it's too late now, but I think it could have been solved by appropriating some of the billions of dollars we give away to communist nations in foreign aid. If we had given that to our own Negroes, I believe we could have built them their own nation, and they would voluntarily have been eager to go there. Well, I think it's a list of North Americans, and I bet a lot of course, the youth people up in Canada, I don't think you have any coons running around up there, do you?
Well, Commander, I wouldn't like to go into a description of what you might describe as a coon, unless you'd like to.
Well, a Martin Luther coon is a good example, I would say. I will say this, if I had the funds to do it, and I could ship 5,000 Negroes, let us call them, up to your city tomorrow morning, you'd have a Negro problem. And it wouldn't be long before you'd be saying, well, now, what are we going to do about this thing?
You'd see them up in cattle cars or Greyhound buses, Commander.
Well, I think the Negroes would be more comfortable, most of them in a cattle car.
Yes, but I just wondered which way you'd rather see them go.
Well, I think the Negroes themselves would prefer to go the way they live. I think they'd like to get a couple of wine bottles and their heroin and their numbers game and everything, get in the cattle car where they all crawl all over each other.
Well, Commander, that's not a very good description of the Negroes we have in Canada.
Negroes simply are not fit to associate in modern urban civilization. They just can't make it. As you can, there are a few of them, always mixed with white blood, by the way, but real black Negroes, you won't find very many of them who can make the grade in urban civilization.
Well, would you say then that there is no Negro who is really in the same league with Commander Rockwell?
No, sir, I would not. There may be some Negroes who are superior to me. But I would say that the chances are 99 out of 100 that I've got a lot of white blood, like Malcolm X. And I would further say that the average Negro is far inferior to anybody in here. The average Negro, not the special Negro that you might trot out that's a PhD, but the average Negro. You go over here on 7th Avenue, and I'll show you thousands of them that are inferior swine.
Commander, your views on Negroes strike me as being viciously extreme. Do you disagree with that?
No, sir. They're not vicious, but they're extreme.
Commander, how do you feel about the allegations that the American Nazi Party has strong homosexual tendencies?
I will say this. In my organization, I had men who were homosexuals. They were sucked into that filth, just like drunkards or dope fiends. And I have been able to rescue them. And I'm not a bit ashamed of that. I'll stand shoulder to shoulder with anyone on many days. The only thing I will not tolerate is a homosexual who is a homosexual.
This is one of your enemies?
That's one of the biggest enemies. I'd rather gas queers than anybody else.
Have you got operatives inside the government?
Yes, sir.
In Congress?
Yep.
In the government of Canada?
I don't know of any in the government of Canada.
Who else would you like to gas besides queers?
Well, I'd like to gas traitors, I've already told you. But queers, to me, queers are traitors to humanity as a whole.
I just wondered if it was a long list of people you'd like to gas.
You can put queers up at the top of the list for my money, and that includes a lot of Jews and liberals, I find, are also queers.
Second music break. Now, in its own esoteric way, this next cut is one of the funniest things I've ever heard, but the joke takes a little bit of explaining. Our performers are Robin and Linda Williams, two of those hippy-dippy folk singer types I referred to earlier, and who are both, by the way, damn fine musicians and singers. It's just their politics that suck. Now, what the Williamses have done in this number is to defile a very old English song called The Cuckoo by rewriting the lyrics to make it serve a 21st century politically correct agenda. This rewriting of our history is, of course, very common among liberals and leftists of all stripes in everything from folk music to movies to academic fields, and they're absolutely mendacious and shameless about it. You'll hear what I mean in the first part of this song, which is their updated, politically correct, green version of The Cuckoo. But then they go into another foot-stomping old banjo piece called The Patter Roller Song. And I have to say again that however screwed up these two are in their minds, they're excellent musicians, and I think you'll really enjoy this piece just on those grounds, just to hear them play. But that second song is where it gets hysterically funny to somebody who knows history, as I do, and as apparently Robin and Linda Williams don't. The thing is, I very, very much doubt that either Robin or Linda Williams have the slightest clue as to what a patter roller is or was. Patter roller is a very old Southern slang word which means patroller or patrolman, and it was used to designate the nightly slave patrols under the old antebellum plantation system. In large parts of the Deep South, where there were a lot of large plantations and hence a lot of niggers, slave revolts were a very serious danger, such as the one in Virginia in 1831, in which over 50 white men, women, and children were murdered. The result was that at night in the South, the local white militia members, or sometimes specially deputized whites employed by the local sheriff, would patrol the roads and hollows, armed and on horseback, looking for any niggers who might be out and about off their plantations and up to no good, holding secret meetings, getting drunk, making trouble, kind of like cops today. When the patrols caught slaves sneaking around after dark without a written pass from their masters, they were apprehended and returned to their plantations, usually after a good working over with a bullwhip. Modern cops don't apply the bullwhip to black hides anymore, which is one reason for the high crime rate today. These men were called patrollers, and that became vulgarized down through the years as patterollers. As per usual, the poor whites got the short end of the stick. The plantation owners themselves were all fast asleep in their beds, drunk on mint juleps or whatever, and the plantation owners' sons were usually off at college or touring Europe or whatever, and in any case could buy their way out of this duty, which paid $2 a night or some similar pittance. And so the work of securing the white community against the black threat caused by the rich men's slave labor fell to the poor white small farmers and woodsmen and craftsmen. Down in the Carolina Lowcountry, these poor whites were called buckramen, probably from the old English word buckram, which was a cheap fabric the poor often wore in the 17th and 18th centuries, and many of them were descended from the indentured servants who had come over from Britain during that time more or less as slaves themselves. It's said that even the black slaves looked down on the buckramen because at least their masters fed them and looked after them while the poor whites were stuck on all the worst swamp and bottom land, and they had to hunt squirrels and scrabble for every mouthful of cornbread. I know this is just a matter of opinion, but in my view, the remaining poor and blue-collar white people of the Carolina Lowcountry, South Georgia, and northern Florida are still, to this day, the leanest and meanest rednecks to be found in the South. Growing up in that hot climate surrounded by all those niggers tends to produce a certain hereditary mindset, shall we say. And need I add, that's where my own family's from. Anyway, getting back to the humor in this song, let's listen now to two dyed-in-the-wool liberals, Robin and Linda Williams, sing a nice, politically correct song about the cuckoo being destroyed by evil capitalist pollution, followed by a merry old traditional banjo tune about running down nigger slaves at night on horseback, flogging them on a live oak tree with a bullwhip, putting them in chains, and returning them to their plantations for another day in the cotton fields.
So high, so I can hear the cuckoo as she goes winging by. Oh, the cuckoo, she's a birdie bird. She warbles as she flies. She flies northward in the springtime. Oh, she tells us no lies. Oh, the springtime, she awakens bearing flowers so fair. Takes no notice of a change in the air.
of silver. He's a cuckoo's demise. For it poisons her blue waters, and it blackens her blue skies. Oh, the girl seizes highways and the skyscrapers tall. But the man who kills a cuckoo, he's a worse man of all.
Got a question now from JJ in Kansas. Dear Mr. Covington, how did the Northwest migration idea get started? I actually don't get that one as often as you might think, but I'm glad to go over it again. The Northwest imperative is not new. I did not invent it, and I make no such claim. An independent white homeland in the Northwest as such was first advocated back in the 1970s by a number of people who most of you have probably never heard of, people like Pastor Bob Miles, Pastor Richard Butler, and of course the heroic freedom fighters of the order. Now, if you want to get really esoteric about it and delve into history, you might say that we go all the way back to the early 1800s with the great conspiracy of Aaron Burr and General James Wilkinson to seize what was then the Louisiana Territory and make it into a new country separate from the United States. Now, wouldn't that have changed history, huh? Or you might say that the modern Northwest idea goes back to the 1940s. At that time, the people of Northern California got so sick and tired of being essentially governed by corrupt politicians in Sacramento who, even back in those days, were responsive only to the equally corrupt cities of Los Angeles and San Francisco and the Jewish Empire down there in Hollywood. And the folks in Northern California got together in the first official secession convention since 1861. I think it was somewhere up around Eureka, California. And they declared Northern California to be a separate state, which they called the State of Jefferson. I guess they figured if Washington had a state named after him, then so could Thomas Jefferson. They were on the verge of petitioning Congress to recognize them as a separate state when Pearl Harbor happened. And so that pretty much put paid to that. But the idea has been there for a long time. I might even add that there is some of the Northern California secession idea left, and there's an actual website at http://www.jeffersonstate.com. That's all one word, jeffersonstate.com, and you can find more information on the state of Jefferson there. The Northwest independence movement has one single overriding imperative, and that is that the world must change. Now, the purpose of democracy is to prevent change. The purpose of revolution is to bring it about, and that is our purpose. I'm not ruling out the possibility that one day the Northwest Front or Northwest Front-backed candidates might run in elections up here. Anything's possible, but it will only be to provide a legal format and a vehicle for revolutionary organizing for our own independent white nation. Specifically, the Northwest Movement is based on a number of principles, all of which I believe are demonstrably true if they're approached with an open mind. One of these is that the white race is faced with literal physical extinction, both here and in Europe. Establishment media now admit that white people will be a minority on this continent by the year 2050. And that doesn't even take into account the problem of the age of the white population at the time. The second basic principle of the Northwest Imperative is that the United States of America, in its present form, is doomed. It's like the poet William Butler Yeats said, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. And we believe that the only way to secure the existence of our people and a future for white children is physical separation from the mud races. And this requires territory, land of our own, and a government of our own. This white homeland must be a sovereign and independent nation. No white Puerto Ricos or any crap like that, where no non-whites and no Jews and no homosexual perverts and no bird-brained liberals are even allowed to live. All those people have to be completely removed from the political and social equation, along with certain other classes of people, as mentioned in our Northwest Constitution, like professional clergy and lawyers. Now, when people say to me, oh, Harold, you're a monster, you're cruel and mean and heartless, I tell them to go take a flying leap at a rolling donut. My eyes are on the prize, folks. I want the result. Yes, Virginia, sometimes the end does justify the means, and that is the case with white survival. The survival of the white race on Earth is non-negotiable. The 14 words of David Lane are non-negotiable, and we need to start manning up and doing what's necessary to make sure there are still some people with our color skin alive on this continent in another 100 years. You can't cure disease without dealing with germs and the infection they cause. Now, historically, human problems are very seldom caused by nature anymore. The Black Death wiped out one-third of Europe in the 14th century, but this isn't the 14th century anymore. Earthquakes in Haiti notwithstanding, the Western world has the science and the technology now to beat famine and plague and to predict and deal with things like hurricanes and volcanoes and repair the damage they do when they occur. Well, a white man does anyway. Black primitives in Haiti don't, but I'm not concerned about them. If global warming were real, which it's not, it wouldn't wipe us out, because science, white man's science, I might add, would find a way to deal with it. No, in recent centuries, human problems have been caused mostly by people, and the only way to put a stop to some problems is to remove certain people from participation in the process. Now, that may sound cruel and cynical, but it's true. And if you look at human history, that's more often than not how mankind solves its problems, through proactive human intervention that one way or another removes certain groups, nations, and races from the picture. Now, that's just the way it is, and it's not going to change just because some people don't have the courage or the energy to do what's necessary to save white people from extinction. Okay, I'm running long here on this ad lib show, but I owe you guys one more music break. And you know, one of the good things about ad libbing like this is that I can change my mind. So let's screw the hippy dippy folk singers of the 60s, and let's get back to the Buckram Man of the South. I like them. Now, here's a Civil War song by Eric Clapton, believe it or not.
White mansions, live oaks, and velvet. that's about to begin. It's gonna get meaner than a Texas high wind. So come on, Caleb, you're a man to join in. When you're fighting Yankees, a redneck's a man's best friend.
Edgar Steele, the man who is now in prison awaiting trial on some of the most ridiculous charges ever fabricated by federal law enforcement, always used to close his nickel rants on the internet with, "New America, an idea whose time has come." Well, I've got a better idea. End America, an idea whose time has come. Every other continent on the face of the earth has many countries on it, and eventually so will our continent. That's just the way it's going to work out. That's the way human nature will shake this up. A century from now, North America will be almost like the old South Africa with Bantustans. The Southwest, from Southern California to Texas, will be Aztlan. It'll be Mexican. There will possibly be a Republic of New Africa or whatever in what is now the South. Unless, of course, the Hispanics push in from Aztlan and kill or enslave all the niggers, which they may do, like they've already done in other places like Brazil and Central America. There may be some remnants of the United States left in the Midwest and the Northeastern Corridor, in theory, ruled over by some decrepit remnant of the Washington, D.C. government, but independent in fact. And above all, there will be a Northwest American Republic for white people only in the states of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Western Montana, and with any luck, bits and pieces of Northern California, British Columbia, Alberta, and maybe Alaska. It will be there 100 years from now because we're going to make it so. Right now, the Northwest Front is sifting, sifting, sifting like a prospector panning a stream. We're looking for that little bit of color in the bottom of the pan. Now, a large part of the people we're sifting are going to be conservatives connected to the Tea Party movement, or maybe not, but like the Marines, we're going to be looking for a few good men and women. Men and women who have a few brain cells to rub together and who can see that despite all the Sarah Palin and Rush Limbaugh crap, the old America is gone forever and we have to start over. We will be sifting through 100 batches of contacts and keeping and nurturing maybe 2 or 3 out of each batch who seem to have a little bit of character and a glimmer of understanding. Now, all I can do is to keep on begging you white folks out there to look in that mirror. And if you don't like what you see, then don't turn away. You know what you have to do. We have the plan now. There's no longer any question. There's no longer any time for argument or debate or introspection. That's not that you can't do it. It's that you won't do it, but you can change that. The road is open for you to be a man again. The road of courage and self-worth, of pride and honor, and eventually of glory, lies open for you just as much as it ever lay open for any Aryan man since the dawn of time. It's the road northwest. Well, our time's up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. Now, this is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.